If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Let's head into the vault. This week, it is part two of our series on the Kuleshov effect. This episode originally aired January 27th, 2022. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our series on the Kuleshov effect. Now, as I explained last time, this is one that originally was going to be one episode. We ended up splitting it in two, so we're doing a little time traveling right now. This is an out-of-sequence introduction, but I guess from here we'll just jump right back into the middle of our conversation from last time.
Let's do it.
Well, anyway, so I wanted to talk about a very interesting paper that analyzed the history and meaning of the Kuleshov effect, and then also tried to recreate the Mozhukin experiment. So this paper was published in the Cinema Journal by Stephen Prince and Wayne E. Hensley, called "The Kuleshov Effect: Recreating the Classic Experiment," the year 1992. I think both of the authors on this paper were at the time professors at Virginia Tech. Stephen Prince is a film scholar who I know has done a lot of work on Akira Kurosawa. Mm. And I'm not going to cover the entire paper, but I just want to note some parts of it that struck me as relevant and interesting. So they start off by telling the story of the Kuleshov effect experiment, the experiment with that actor Mozhukin making the neutral face and then either being intercut with soup or with the woman in the coffin, and the audience is raving about how expressive and powerful the emotions in the performance were. Now, one thing they do at the beginning is they note some differences in the details of the story that arise from different recountings of it. And so they end up casting doubt on whether the accounts of this experiment are, first of all, historically accurate, and second, analytically valid. And so the authors write, quote, "The goal here is to provide a clearer contextualization of Kuleshov's work, distinguishing between its incontrovertible importance for an understanding of how cinema communicates and certain of its limitations, especially its incautious merging of theoretical claim and observational assertion. As we will see, Kuleshov may have been right, but perhaps for the wrong reasons." So the top line of this paper is that they try to recreate the Mozhukin experiment as it is usually described, and they do not produce the same result. But this doesn't necessarily mean that the broader implications of the Kuleshov effect are wrong, theoretically. But it might mean something about the specific claims about a neutral face. So they start off talking about Kuleshov's belief in the power of montage and his arguments that editing is far more important to the meaning generated by a film than the contents of the shots. So they talk about the Mazhukin experiment and then the other things we mentioned, creative geography and creative anatomy. And they describe the general takeaway from the Mazhukin experiment as follows, quote, "Naturalistic emotive performances by actors were not considered by Kuleshov to be essential to cinema. Because of the demands of montage, actors were to provide minimal, restrained, and fairly unambiguous gestural and facial expressions. As Kuleshov puts it, quote, the presence of montage necessitated that the shots should be constructed simply, clearly, distinctly. Otherwise, the flickering of a rapid montage would not be sufficient for a full scrutiny of its contents." And then the authors go on, reacting partly against the over-emoting found in some silent films, Kuleshov noted that, quote, a preoccupation with psychologism rooted in the actor's performance was quite useless for the cinema. So in a lot of ways, it sounds like Kuleshov kind of wanted to take the acting out of acting. He was like, there's too much psychology in acting. What we need instead is just sort of like shots of actors doing kind of like plain, unambiguous moments that can then be selected by the editor to insert in a sequence to make meaning of.
It reminds me of so many other discussions we've had about, you know, performance and direction. I'm always reminded of that final sequence from Aguirre, The Wrath of God, where you have you have what ends up being a rather balanced and interesting performance by Klaus Kinski, but apparently it's because Werner Herzog just wore him out, made him do take after take until he wasn't doing like a frenzied, overacting, overly intense performance. He's not raging; he's just actually emoting it at the level that the director wants, and then can therefore be used effectively in the edit.
Yeah. And though if that story is true, it may have worked in this case. I want to say I do not necessarily endorse directing by exhaustion.
No. Well, that was a special relationship, obviously. Yeah. But you often see this brought up, and you know, there's this idea of like, is this about the actor and the acting performance? Is it about editing? Is it about the director's vision? And you do often see that sort of push and pull, be it, you know, Klaus Kinski and Werner Herzog or Jimmy Stewart and Alfred Hitchcock. The actor has a certain vision about how things need to be, and then the director maybe has another idea, not only about like this particular character and this particular performance, but how it fits into the overall film, how it fits into the final edit. And so you could imagine somebody going into it with this sort of very Kuleshov idea of just shoot, all we need are just neutral actors. We don't really need any of this emotion one way or another. And I don't know, there are probably some examples of filmmakers who tend to lean in that direction with very neutral performances.
Yeah, you could almost look at that approach as something that might be more common, say, in like music videos and stuff than in narrative films, but you can probably find it some in narrative films as well, where the filming part of the filmmaking process is just sort of like creating a bunch of building blocks that can later be used in various arrangements to do whatever the director or editor later decides to do with them.
Yeah. It also reminds me how, a lot of the films we watch in Weird House Cinema will sometimes feature non-actors. Or very, very green actors. But the right sort of non-actor can really excel in a scene if utilized correctly, you know, like not the kind of non-actor where they're just really outrageous with, but where they're just sort of, they're very neutral. They're almost barely there at all. And if enough of the other stuff is in the right place, it can really work.
Now, I got to say, though, as this paper ends up describing Kuleshov's theory of film and montage, I think I can't agree with what it sounds like Kuleshov's vision actually was, because Kuleshov apparently said things like, the film shot is not a still photograph. The shot is a sign, a letter for montage. I think he's saying like a still photograph can have meaning on its own, but a shot in a movie is more like a letter in a sentence, something which does not have meaning on its own, but is combined in sequence to make meaning. Clearly, that has some truth to it, because as we've said, editing does constitute a major part of the sense-making or meaning-making of a film. But I think that's also pretty overstated. You know, a lot of meaning lies in the editing, but the contents of the shots also stand alone to a greater extent and matter a lot more than Kuleshov was giving credit here. Though, again, to be fair, I think it's important for us not to forget that in the 19-teens and early 1920s, you know, film was still fairly young, editing was still fairly new in cinema, and its powers were still being discovered. You know, it's like we talked about, the very earliest films from the 1890s and such were usually not edited at all. They'd just be one continuous shot. And even after editing was introduced, films of the silent era typically did not have as many cuts as movies we're used to today.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, the authors of this 92 paper argue that a theory comparing film to language is actually not super useful, because there's just a lot of ways in which that doesn't work. Like, film does things language cannot do, so you don't have to learn a language to appreciate the meanings of films. You learn some conventions, but you know, you can just watch a movie and make some sense of it, even if you're not familiar with conventions. To understand a language, you have to learn the language. Meanwhile, language does things that film can't do, like photographic images used in a film cannot be recombined freely to make endless meaning the way a language can.
Right.
There's also an interesting digression in this paper about Kuleshov being influenced by the ideology of industrial efficiency on the model of the American engineer Frederick Taylor, who was a big proponent of finding ways to make, you know, production processes in factories more efficient, finding all the places where waste and problems creep in and eliminating those. And that Taylor's ideas of industrial efficiency were apparently very popular in the Soviet Union at the time. And that in a way, the authors say that you could view Kuleshov's emphasis on economy and acting as a type of industrial efficiency technique applied to film theory.
Yeah, I mean, based on what I was reading, it does seem like a lot of his work was based in, let's figure out what's working, and then how we can do that. What is the most economic means of making effective film?
Now, ultimately, Prince and Hensley make the case that Kuleshov really was trying to dress up his theoretical convictions about how film works with the imprimatur of empirical science, with this alleged experiment, the Mazhukin experiment. And I think I'm pretty convinced by their description of it that way. I think this is something you've always got to be cautious of, because obviously, you know, I don't object in principle to exploring or building upon artistic theories with empirical methods. But I would also say my personal opinion is that a lot of these efforts to inject scientific methods into aesthetics and art and stuff can be confusing and unnecessary. Like, I don't think you have to have an empirical scientific justification for an opinion about where meaning comes from in art or in film. Obviously, I'm a huge believer in empirical science. I just don't think it has to pervade every domain. Like, aesthetics and art don't necessarily need scientific evidence and theories behind them. Those fields just, you know, work by different standards. And I think also a lot of times if you try to generate empirical scientific justifications for your beliefs about art or aesthetics or whatever, you're often just going to end up doing sloppy experiments or drawing unjustified conclusions, even if you do a good one.
Yeah. Like, I'm reminded, you know, of the fact that obviously you have such a thing as outsider art and outsider cinema. And examples of outsider art and outsider cinema can be amazing. You know, and on the other side of things, you don't hear as much about maybe outsider architecture, outsider structural engineering, things of this nature. Outsider medicine is probably best avoided if you can, no matter how it's being dressed up.
Well, I mean, I think empirical methods are good for fields in which you are trying to achieve very clearly specified goals, certain kinds of outcomes, and get them as reliably as possible. And empirical methods are less important in fields where you're just trying to be expressive or be creative and see what kind of emergent results come out.
But if it's like this turns my mind to like A/B testing and focus groups, used in film and television. Not necessarily a bad idea at all, especially when you're dealing, again, with a very mainstream product. You want to appeal to a wide population of individuals. But, there are plenty of arguments to be made about it as a potential, sloppy experiment, as you say. Perhaps one of the best critiques of all of this is that episode of The Simpsons, The Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie Show.
One of my favorites. It's just an old creaky mirror. Sometimes it sounds like it's coughing or talking softly.
Yes. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
But anyway, to come back to Prince and Henley's description of methodological problems with the common descriptions of Kuleshov's alleged experiment, the Mazhukin experiment with the neutral face and the soup and the coffin and stuff. And they list a bunch of questions. They say, quote, "For such a seminal and basically uncontested study, there is virtually no information available about Kuleshov's actual method and procedure. Did he, for example, interview the subjects individually or in a group? What did he tell them beforehand about the purpose of the presentation? What, if anything, did he tell them about the nature of film editing or montage? What was the frequency of outlier opinions, e.g. people who did not think Mazhukin was saddened by the dead woman? Published accounts suggest the responses were uniform. Was this so? Unfortunately, we do not know the answers to any of these questions." So given these limitations, they attempt to recreate and try to replicate as best they can the conditions of the original experiment to see if they get the same result. So what they did was they put together a videotape. They had some auditions for actors to produce a close-up shot of a face that was just totally neutral and expressionless. And they had to go through a couple of rounds because in the first round, the actor's neutral face was not perceived as neutral enough by the control group. So they got a neutral face on a video, and they did the same thing. They intercut it with a woman lying in a coffin, a girl playing with a teddy bear, and a bowl of soup on a table. And they tried as best they could to follow Kuleshov's cues about what the cinematography techniques for making this work the best would be. So it would be people visible on a darkened black velvet background. Apparently, the actors were told that they just needed someone to model for an instructional video in which they would be required to do an expressionless or neutral face. So one difference is that instead of one long sequence intercutting with all of them, they did separate sequences for each reaction. So, for example, it might go face, soup, face, fade out, or face, coffin, face, fade out. And each shot was 7 seconds long. And the separate sequences make sense to me because you might get a different reaction with some pairings than you would with others. So viewers each saw one sequence selected at random, and they were told that the experimenters needed help evaluating an acting performance. And then the viewers were supposed to select from a list of emotions that they thought were being portrayed by the actor. Options included happiness, sadness, anger, fear, surprise, disgust, hunger, no emotion, and other. Apparently, the participants were undergrads at a mid-Atlantic university. I'm going to assume, based on the author's affiliations, this was probably Virginia Tech. They said that, interestingly, film students were excluded from the experiment since they might detect the connection to Kuleshov and understand what the experiment was getting at, which could bias results. And in support of this decision, I mean, it seems like a good choice either way, but to justify this decision, they wrote about another recent attempt to replicate the Mazhukin experiment in France among film students who allegedly gave answers like the following, quote, "We know that the man does not change his expression, but because of the montage, we think we see him change," or, quote, "We know the Kuleshov effect and it works." And then Prince and Hensley also had a control condition where they showed the face to 24 film students this time, but without any intercutting. They were just showing them the face by itself and asking them what emotion it was showing. For the face that they actually used in the experiment, 88% said there was no emotion on the face. So this is a very good neutral face.
You know, that reminds me, though, of use of neutral face, sort of not still pictures, but just scene sequences where a character or an individual is staring directly into the camera. I'm thinking certainly about Ron Frick's 1992 film Baraka, which features a number of these sequences where you'll just have an individual from one culture or another just staring into the camera. Mm-hmm. Or another example that comes to mind is the 1986 film The Mission, where at the very end of the film, you just have several beats of one of the primary characters staring into the camera, you know, in a very neutral expression. And of course, you have the entire film you've just watched to help inform your idea of what's going through that character's head. But still, it's a great use of neutral expression. Like he doesn't look particularly sad in that case, but you can see sadness in the character, you know?
Well, yeah, that's a good example, but I think it also does raise questions about something that's supposed to be sort of outside the standard interpretation of this experiment, which is like, well, wait, what are the actual contents of the face? Maybe that does matter. That's going to come up in the author's interpretation of the results they get. But so in the actual experiment they did, they had 137 participants, including the control group. In the experimental group, in every condition, whether it was soup, coffin, or child, the majority of people said there was no emotion. So they saw the face that was supposedly neutral. They saw it intercut with whatever it was, the soup or the coffin, and they said, nope, there is no emotion on this face. Mm-hmm. In the soup condition, 68% selected no emotion. In both the child and the coffin condition, 61% said no emotion. And so comparing that to the control group, in the control, 88% said there was no emotion. And that dropped down to 68 in the soup and 61 in the child and the coffin. So you could say this is a small increase in perceived emotion, though the authors note that for the size of the group they tested, it actually doesn't reach statistical significance. So it might just be a random fluke. Furthermore, in the cases where the viewers picked an emotion, it was usually not the expected emotion, so it was not happiness for the child and so forth. So either way, this experiment finds something somewhere between no effect and small effect on perceived emotion, which is a very far cry either way from Kuleshov's reports about the audience's unanimous raving about the actor's subtle emotional performances. And so the authors say here that, you know, unless contrary evidence emerges, it seems true to say that, quote, the Kuleshov effect as reported no longer exists, even if the effect did play a role at one time. Though emphasis there should be on as reported, because some of the broader implications of it probably do still hold true. Now, this raises an interesting question. If we assume, for the sake of argument, that Kuleshov was basically reporting the results of his experiment accurately, or with only slight exaggeration, what could account between the difference? Why did Kuleshov get people raving about the subtle emotion in the neutral face, but that didn't really happen in a modern experiment? The authors offer some ideas here, and I think they're all pretty possible, viable, and certainly interesting. So one would be changes in audience expectation. You know, audiences today are accustomed to highly effective editing techniques that have been perfected over time, such as, like I mentioned earlier, the preservation of eye lines to enforce continuity of perspective and reverse shots.
Yeah. I think this is a big one. And it comes down to like some of the basics of what we said earlier about how, at least for many of us, and certainly for me, like trying to watch an actual Kuleshov film is very difficult. Like it's just, film has come so, has evolved so much since then. Mm-hmm. And the effects are subtle in a way that the film only has to be even halfway competent to really just draw right. you in and create the illusion.
Right. So the authors write, quote, it may be that a modern audience, by virtue of increased media exposure relative to Kuleshov's day, has become accustomed to a more systematic and complex set of associational cues, such as those supplied by the continuity system of editing, and is correspondingly less likely to respond to a montage sequence that employs a blank face and minimal, if any, associative cues within shots. So maybe the bar for perceiving emotion in films has gone up. You know, it's just harder to do now. And at the time that Kuleshov did his experiment, allegedly, maybe the audiences were just more, it was easier for them to project that emotion. Now there could be a number of ways to read that. One way is thinking about how much exposure modern audiences have to modern editing techniques. The other way, I guess, and the authors don't really favor this explanation, but they say another way of looking at it is naivete on the part of the early audiences. There's some kind of projection going on because maybe early film audiences were just so bewildered by moving pictures that they almost like hallucinated projections of emotion. The authors don't think this is a very good explanation, for one thing, because they argue that a lot of the stories that are used to illustrate the sort of bewilderment of early film audiences, like the semi-mythological things about the audiences running away from the Lumiere train and stuff, that they say that, I mean, there were sort of events of this kind, but they have been mythologized in a way that overemphasizes how naive early audiences were, and that a lot of these kinds of reactions may have just been audiences playing along. They're at the theater having a good time, and they're playing along with what the suggested reaction was supposed to be.
That's true. Once you, especially when you're dealing with a group of people, you know, watching anything with a group, even today with our modern exposure to cinema, you know, if one person jumps, everybody can jump, that sort of thing. You know, you're more likely to laugh or scream if you're watching it with other people, that sort of thing.
It makes me think about William Castle and The Tingler trying to get people screaming in the movie theaters.
Yeah. Which is infectious. As I think I mentioned in that Tingler episode, I got to see The Tingler in a theater, and people were totally playing into it. Like, it still worked today.
So good. Okay, a couple of other possible explanations for the difference between Kuleshov's report and then the failed attempt to replicate those findings. Another one is response bias. So this seems quite possible to me. Maybe it was originally a sloppy experiment. Maybe Kuleshov primed his test subjects to react the way they did, and they complied. This is why double-blind tests are very useful. If the person administering the test doesn't know what hypothesis is being tested, it's harder for them to behave in a way that would bias the subject response in favor of it. Mm-hmm. And there is, of course, extensive evidence that Kuleshov was already committed to his theory about the power of montage before he allegedly conducted this experiment. Like, he already had the result he was looking for in mind.
Yeah, like the neutral face. I keep thinking of examples now of neutral face or very neutral or just, you know, low-key acting performances. And one that instantly comes to mind is the sequence in The Godfather where Al Pacino's character is in the restaurant. With the corrupt police officer and
Sterling Hayden and
and the Turk, right? Is that the other character? His name
Sollozzo.
Yeah. Sollozzo. And of course, what's going to happen is he's going to go to the toilet. He's going to come back with a gun, and then he's going to shoot them both. That's the plan. And there's that great sequence where you see Al Pacino's face, and he had a very, again, very neutral expression. And I previously just always thought, well, that's just. He was such a great actor at that point in his career. Like you can just see the wheels turning. You can see all the tension going on behind the scenes, but maybe not. Maybe he's just thinking about, what he needs to pick up at the grocery store later on in the day. And it's just all about everything else going on in the scene and how it's been put together.
That could be. There are actually a number of shots in The Godfather in particular where they're memorable because of Al Pacino's expressionless face. Like when Carlo Rizzi confesses at the end to having killed Sonny and Michael just looks at him with the blank expression, but you read a lot into that blank expression. It is a murderous blank expression.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another way of reading the Al Pacino example here and also of possibly interpreting the original Mazhukin experiment. I really like this explanation. What if Kuleshov's montage was loaded with more conventional emotional content than he claimed? There could be a million ways this could be true, but for example, what if there was something special about the face of Mazhukin? What if there was something special about the face that Kuleshov used in this supposedly neutral test film that was less neutral than we would be led to believe? The authors of this 92 paper note, quote, "There is a difference between an expressionless face and an ambiguous expression."
Mm-hmm.
And they cite an experience from their own experiment. They talk about how the very first tape they created of somebody trying to do a neutral face had to be rejected and replaced with a different actor because it failed to be rated as neutral in the control condition. So that was the control. When there were no shots juxtaposed, the control group thought they perceived a range of emotions in the first neutral face they looked at. And then the authors got a different tape, different actor, and it succeeded at being perceived as more neutral in the original control.
This is great to point out, the difference between a neutral face and an ambiguous face, because obviously this is one of the arguments for why the Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci is such an admired piece of art, is not because you can easily read what the Mona Lisa is thinking or feeling, but she has this ambiguous countenance.
Right, and the difference would be that there is a difference between ambiguous and neutral. Neutral is something we look at and we see, I don't see any emotion on that face. Ambiguous is you see emotion, but it's not clear what it is. It maybe suggests something that could go in different directions.
Mm-hmm.
The authors come back to talking about this more ambiguous, more emotional face that they got the first time they tried to record a tape. They said, quote, "When other viewers were shown this face in sequence, many attributed a wide range of emotions to the actor, some consistent with a Kuleshov effect, others not. The sequence with the soup, for example, elicited interpretations of apathy, disgust, contemplation, detachment, dislike, indifference, lack of interest, as well as an occasional attribution of hunger. The ambiguous expression seemed to offer a stronger interpretive cue for the viewer than did the expressionless face. If Kuleshovian montage may not be capable of making an expressionless face emotive, it may very well do with an ambiguous expression, since the objects, like soup, coffin, or child, provide a context for resolving the ambiguity." And I think this interpretation seems very likely to me because, again, the allegation is that Mazhukin was a famed actor. And so there's naturally, you can imagine a famed actor's face has something special about it. It's kind of brimming with the implication of emotion, even when they're being relatively subtle or not, you know, offering a big smile or frown or whatever.
Right, right. That this may well have been the sort of performer that was highly aware of what their face is doing, that is, you know, that is practiced in front of the mirror, that knows what they're projecting, and therefore, to a certain extent, might be incapable of a neutral face, at least when told to pull some sort of face.
Right. So if there is something to this interpretation, I would say that the Kuleshov effect, even in the specific case of interpreting neutral faces as, based on the editing context, it's absolutely tapping into something real, but there might be like thresholds or limits. Like there is some truth to it, but it can't overcome some truly deeply blandly neutral faces, you know, like some ambiguous faces just offer more hooks on which to hang emotional values created by the context.
Yeah, yeah. I also wonder, you know, what would happen if you took exceptional faces and you threw them in, you know, and not necessarily even exceptionally dashing faces, but like just exceptionally evocative faces, like a Peter Lorre, you know, if you put Peter Lorre in there, even though he's going to do a neutral or ambiguous face, what would happen to the experiment? Though, of course, in that case, you'd also have to not know it was Peter Lorre. Because then you're gonna start typecasting, like, oh, we know what kind of guys this actor plays.
Yeah, so, you'd be suspicious. You'd be reading negative emotional or suspicious mind content.
What is he planning for that soup? He's going to poison that soup, isn't he?
Right. Anyway, I think the authors make the point in the end that the broader implications of the Kuleshov myth, that individual shots which may be low on meaning or emotion by themselves can become highly charged with meaning by the power of the surrounding editing. This is obviously true, and it is largely the basis for the magic of cinema. But the specific claim about supposedly neutral faces appears to be not true, at least for some audiences or some faces. But this raises really interesting questions, like, what are the properties of the maximally Kuleshov ambiguous face? What kind of skills would you want an actor to have to be able to have these subtle ambiguous expressions that can be sort of driven any which way by the surrounding context, by a bowl of soup or by a coffin?
I guess, I'm just guessing here, but the bare minimum, you need to have some sort of like spark of attention. Like there seems, it's not enough perhaps to just rely solely on the editing to imply that there's a connection between this shot and the other. But the person's face appears to be looking with interest at something, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think sometimes with these studies, like the face doesn't just look neutral. It looks like it's not seeing anything.
Right. Like if it's just a like mugshot and then a plate of spaghetti, like, okay, you showed me a mugshot and you showed me some spaghetti.
Maybe something that's crucial is that even if they're not showing a very clear emotion, that it looks like they're looking at whatever is being shown.
Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So Prince and Henley is very interesting, but it was by no means the last study on the Kuleshov effect, the last attempt to look at it empirically. And actually, since then, some other studies have kind of come back on the other side, have found a little more support for the original alleged finding. So one example is the study by Dean Mobbs et al. From 2006 called The Kuleshov Effect, The Influence of Contextual Framing on Emotional Attributions. This was in Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience. And the test here was a little bit different, but they did basically look for the same type of effect and did succeed in producing it experimentally. So in this case, they didn't use just a single supposedly neutral face as the stimulus. They used neutral faces and then what they called faces displaying subtly fearful or happy facial expressions, which if you want to look up the study, you can see the stimuli they used. They're faces that are almost neutral. They've just got the barest little hint of a smile or kind of an apprehensive frown. And then they put together a task where they would they paired it with neuroimaging in this study. So they'd have people doing neuroimaging while they gave them the task to look at this face and then imagine that the person is watching a movie of various kinds. It could be a happy movie scene or a scary movie scene. And they did find that people were, on average, more likely to interpret neutral or only very subtle expressive faces more in alignment with the emotion that you would expect if they believed the person was watching either a scary or a happy movie. And so it's worth noting that there is an effect here, but it's not as shockingly powerful and unanimous as like those original tellings of the Kuleshov experiment would suggest.
Hmm. Yeah, this is interesting. This is something we'll continue to look at. I also like that they were looking at scary and happy movie scenes because it also brings to mind episodes we've done in the past on audience reactions to scary movies and how oftentimes like the reaction you have to a pleasant movie or certainly a funny movie compared to that of a scary movie, they may be more alike than one might think.
Oh, yeah, because a lot of times people laugh when something is scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, laughing, reacting to the way that people around them are reacting. And if you are acting frightened during a frightening movie, I feel like it's very often a kind of excited frightening, you know, that safe kind of like I am afraid for the characters, but I'm not necessarily afraid for myself.
You know, I've actually wondered before if so a lot of my movie going entertainment pleasure comes from watching B horror movies essentially as unintentional comedies and having a good time laughing along with them. But I wonder if part of that grows out of a kind of defense mechanism learned in childhood that I could protect myself from something scary if I sort of forced myself to see it instead as something funny.
Yeah, I don't know. I certainly catch myself going like, more like that exact sound if it is, say, a slightly goofy or goofy monster that is suddenly jumping out as opposed to a more, effective looking special effect. There's something about, I don't know, it's probably, you know, all this is highly subjective, but for me at least, you know, maybe I'm just leaning into the imagination more in those cases.
Now, just very briefly, I wanted to point out a couple more studies I dug up that looked into the Kuleshov effect more recently than this one. So there was a study in the journal Perception in 2016 by Daniel Barrett et al. Called Does the Kuleshov Effect Really Exist? Revisiting a Classic Film Experiment on Facial Expressions and Emotional Context. So they note some of the stuff we already did, doubts about the original experiment, and then the fact that recent attempts to reproduce the effect have had conflicting results. So they tried it out with a group of 36 participants who were presented with 24 film sequences of neutral faces across six different emotional conditions, so trying to reproduce the same effect. And they actually did find a correlation. It may not have been huge, but they said, quote, "For each emotional condition, the participants tended to choose the appropriate category more frequently than alternative options, while the answers to the valence and arousal questions also went in the expected direction." So they did find a mild existence of the Kuleshov effect in their research here. And then there was another one by Baranowski and Haight in Perception in 2017 called The Auditory Kuleshov Effect, Multisensory Integration in Movie Editing. This study tried to see if there were any Kuleshov-type effects, not for cross-cutting with visual images, but for music. So the question is, does music affect what emotions people detect on other people's supposedly neutral faces? And according to the authors of this study, their results were yes. They found that sad music did in fact make people more likely to rate a supposedly neutral face as sad and vice versa.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, music, especially music and film, is highly manipulative at times.
Yes.
And I think we've all seen experiments with this, sort of amateur experiments with this online, where you take Johnny Cash's cover of Nine Inch Nails' "Hurt" and you play it in the background of virtually any neutral or ambiguous footage, and you're going to get a sense of like deep personal anguish and hurt.
I'm just putting it all together in my mind right now. I'm seeing clips from like Happy Gilmore or something, but with the Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
To see if I still feel. Oh, and then finally, one last one. There was a paper by Mullenix et al. From 2019 in PLOS-1 that also looked at the Kuleshov effect, trying to see if it existed for still photographs instead of dynamic film sequences. And the authors say, yes, they did the Kuleshov type experiment, but just with still photos. And they found there was, in fact, a Kuleshov type effect for still images.
Okay. Also not surprising to me anyway.
So it looks like more of the recent studies into this have found some kind of effect, though I think sometimes the effects are, you know, the kinds of things you're more likely to normally see in psychology experiments, kind of modest effects rather than the overwhelming unanimous effect described in the original Majukin experiment.
Now, I'd like to take all these points we've been hitting and come back around to something that I briefly discussed, and that was Leonardo da Vinci's famous 16th century painting, the Mona Lisa. One of the most intriguing aspects of this painting is the ultimate ambiguity of the expression. You know, the Mona Lisa smile, especially. It's a slight smile. It's a kind of an ambiguous smile. What is she smiling about or beginning to smile about? You know, there have been a number of papers written about this, and I'm certainly not going to do them all justice here, but I wanted to touch on some findings that I think can potentially contribute to this conversation.
Now, wait, did this originally come up in our making a distinction between neutrality and ambiguity? And so,
yes.
So that maybe you're suggesting that the Mona Lisa's face might be one of those famous faces that is ambiguous but not neutral.
Right. It doesn't look like a death mask, but also, you know, she's not scowling. She doesn't look like Vigo the Carpathian. She's not smiling ear to ear. It's a very interesting expression, to say the least, that people have been discussing and studying for decades and for ages. So I'm not going to cover all the studies, but there have been plenty. But I was looking at one. This was a theory that was put forth by Professor Margaret Livingston of Harvard University. She argues that a lot of what fascinates us about this painting is because the smile appears differently depending on where you're standing in position to the painting. So if you look at it with your foveal or direct vision, then arguably there's not really a smile going on there. But if you view it from your with your peripheral vision out of the corner of your eye, then it seems like there's a pronounced smile. Now this doesn't little tidbit doesn't particularly have a lot to reveal about the broader topic we're discussing here. But I found it interesting just talking and indeed it's one that you can pull up an image of the Mona Lisa on your computer, your phone, or if you have it, you know, a copy hanging in your house, you can do it this way as well. And you'll find, I think, that you do get this effect. If you kind of look at it out of the corner of your eyes, it seems like there's a pronounced smile. Look at her directly, and it's not there.
I see exactly what you mean. Another interesting thing is that my mental image of the Mona Lisa is smiling more than the actual image seems to be when I look at it.
Yeah.
Something about the lower resolution copy in my brain appears to have accentuated the smile. And maybe somehow that's picking up on the kind of subtle shading of the contours of her cheeks, which looks like they could be continuing the lines of her mouth, but it's not her mouth.
Yeah, yeah. So, I think that's very much it. And of course, you can get into deeper discussions of, you know, to what extent, you know, this is intended and, you know, what Leonardo da Vinci's trying to do with this, because another aspect of the smile that's frequently brought up is that it's not a symmetrical smile, and this is often cited as one of the key interesting aspects of the Mona Lisa's smile, of Mona Lisa's face in general. Now, the emotional impact of her expression has been much debated over the years, and is like a lot of what we discussed in part one and in this episode. It's one of those areas where you can science it all day, but you're still working with subjective art rather than objective principles. But there are some papers that I think have some revealing information based generally on, you know, smallish studies, asking people to look at the painting or look at portions of the painting. Sometimes they've been manipulated in a key way, and see what people have to say about it. And this is where we're getting, into something that's more in line with the broader topic here. When you look at the Mona Lisa, what kind of emotional understanding is passing between the painting and yourself?
Does it depend on what painting is across the room from her on the other wall? So like what you're perceiving her to be looking at?
They didn't get into that as much, but I couldn't help but think of it. I kept thinking of her looking at soup and so forth.
Yeah.
One paper I was looking at was a 2019 paper from Marsili et al. Published in Cortex, the journal Cortex, in which the researchers asked 42 individuals to rate which of the six basic emotions, as well as a neutral expression of emotion, was related in chimerical images constructed from the photo. So chimerical images in this sense are formed from opposing halves of a pair of same or different faces, usually in like studies and courtroom settings. But in this case, it would be like, you know, my understanding here is like mirroring different parts of the face, dealing with the asymmetry, you know, like what if you had side A is the and you just cloned it onto side B, that sort of thing. Now, the results in this case indicated that happiness is expressed only on the left side of Mona Lisa's face, not on the right. This actually leans into the interpretation that the Mona Lisa smile is not a legitimate smile at all, but a fake smile, something that is either, you know, a noteworthy subject of the art in and of itself, or has a more specific, even cryptic purpose in Da Vinci's art here. I think potentially makes it, you know, more interesting piece. It's not just a painting of a woman smiling. It's a painting of a woman pretending to smile faintly.
This is interesting because I know that's something I've read, and I don't know how legitimate this is, but I've at least read facial expression ambiguity as one of the features people use to detect fakery of emotions in others. So when people look at somebody else and they see that their smile is asymmetrical, they're more likely to think they're faking it.
Right, right. And this is a topic we've covered on the show before, because you get into that whole topic of micro expressions and reading micro expressions, and the idea that that a fake smile looks one way, but there's a more pronounced muscle definition to a legitimate smile. And so that's on its own is something we might take into account when considering ambiguous, like semi-happy, semi-smiling, ambiguous images, ambiguous faces used in one of these experiments. Now, another study I looked at here was one from 2017 by Liachi et al., published in Scientific Reports. The researchers here manipulated, this one's actually kind of funny, I think, manipulated Mona Lisa's mouth curvature and studied how a range of happier and sadder face variants influence perceptions of her emotions. So the actual paper gets into a lot of, like, they bust out some equations and math on this. But basically, they're just doing what you're imagining now, like making the smile more pronounced or making it less pronounced. And they were able to manipulate perception along a sadness-happiness spectrum, but contended ultimately that their data indicates that the natural Mona Lisa, at any rate, is always happy. But I found this more telling. Quote, observers recognize positive facial expressions faster than negative expressions. This is not a finding, but just a reality that they were discussing in the paper. So in other words, faces spiraling down through neutrality, ambiguity, and into other emotional states require more contemplation, and I'm making assumptions here, but more nuance. So like the face that's smiling ear to ear, or is in a, you know, the Vigo the Carpathian scowl, we don't have to think long and hard about that. Like, what kind of emotion is this person having about the soup? We know that they're either ecstatic over the soup, or they just hate the soup, or something involved with the soup. We don't have to think about it much. But when you have that ambiguous smile, or even a slight frown, you know, that's when that really makes you think. You're like, what is this person thinking? My theory of mind has to maybe engage more to try and figure it out. And then ultimately, we have to remember, I mean, one of the key things about people's faces is that the face itself is a communication array. So, like, we're trying to get information potentially about that soup, right? Like, this individual might know if that soup is good. I want to know, like, what the inside track is on the soup. Or on other human beings before I myself decide how I feel about it.
I know this is sort of beside your main point, but it also makes me think about the strange biological contingency that one of the main features of that communication array is also the hole that soup goes in.
It's true.
You ever think about how weird that is? You know, it didn't have to be that way, but we cram in nutrition and speak through the same orifice. It's weird.
It's true. It's weird. But, you know, it's always a reminder that we shouldn't try and do both at the same time. Right? But to bring it back to Kuleshov, I do think this drives home a little bit the susceptibility of ambiguous faces. You know, that we can, if the face is ambiguous, we have to think more about it. We have to think more about the context, but, you know, what is the relationship between shot A and shot B?
Right. I mean, that would go along with what Mobs et al. Said in their background again, which is that, you know, the broad finding of behavioral research is that people rely most on context to interpret the faces of others when the clarity of the facial expression is low. So that could be ambiguity or other things, maybe just like it's hard to see. And when the clarity of the context is high, so when there's information in the context and less information in the face, you reach for the context.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Well, anyway, I guess this all brings us back to one of the questions posed by the Prince and Hensley paper, which is, you know, I wonder if certain actors are just more likely to give rise to this effect than others are. And that, again, drawing on that observation that there's actually a difference between a neutral face and an ambiguous face, I was trying to think of examples of actors whose what you might call blank or neutral faces might tend more toward expressive ambiguity rather than true neutrality. So even when their face is supposedly at rest, you could look at it and it would seem valid to interpret a wide range of intense emotions to them. The best example I could think of, and I didn't pick him just because I love him as an actor, though I do, the best example I could think of was Toshiro Mifune, who you might know from Akira Kurosawa movies. You know, he's the star of Yojimbo and movies like that. I would say he is somebody who, even when he's doing something very stoic with his face, even when his face appears to be at rest, you could easily imagine that it is expressing a range of diametrically opposing emotions. And Rob, I pasted in a picture for you to look at here that's just a portrait of him. I don't think this is even from a film. I think this might just be like a studio portrait still, because this is one where I've seen, you know, like that he's done autographs on and stuff. To my eye, in this portrait, he could be happy. He could be sad. He could be affectionate. He could be hungry. He could be angry. All seem totally plausible with the expression on his face. And I guess this seems to correspond with the fact that I'd say he's an actor known simultaneously for having a highly emotionally expressive face and for often playing kind of stoic characters.
Yeah. You think about especially some of the samurai type characters that he played. It tends to be an intense stoicism to those characters. Though at the same time, I mean, you think of his the Macbeth character, the equivalent of Macbeth that he plays in Throne of Blood. You know, certainly he's, you know, there's plenty of wide-eyed crazy shots in that film, especially towards the end. But yeah, a lot of the characters he plays have a certain sternness, a certain stoic quality that ultimately has an intense ambiguity to it.
And it makes me think about a difference that, you know, sometimes you read psychological studies that are measuring emotions in some context, and they measure emotions in terms of both valence and intensity, where valence means what the emotion is. So it could be like positive emotion or negative emotion, and intensity is how strongly it is felt. Thinking about this makes me wonder if maybe there are some people whose emotional expression naturally tends to be high in intensity even when the valence is unknown or unclear, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wonder if that's especially the kind of person that you use a picture of that kind of actor trying to do a neutral face, but then you do a Kuleshov type experiment and people would be like, yes, you know, you show them looking at the coffin, they're very sad. You show them looking at the soup, they are ravenous. Whereas there are other actors whose faces just more successfully convey a blank neutrality where people see it and they say, I don't think this person's feeling anything.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a good point. And to try and sort of prove it out for our own purposes, you posted this picture of a Mifune in our notes, and I posted a picture of soup next to him. Uh-huh. And indeed, if I look at the two and I sort of go back and forth, I can lean into different interpretations. Like, is he is angry that the soup has been served? Maybe it was served too early, or it's clearly cold, or he just had the soup yesterday, and therefore he is irate. But he also could be like, yes, now it is time to really get into this soup. It is
awesome.
Soup time.
Yeah,
yeah, or various other interpretations.
You know, weirdly, some of the other actors I know who fit into this mold are not just film actors. I mean, a lot of them are film actors, but especially people who have done like modeling, like fashion modeling or art mm-hmm. modeling. Like Grace Jones comes to mind as somebody mm-hmm. who could have a facial expression that is ambiguous in valence but high in intensity.
No, yeah, I definitely can see that with Grace Jones. I was trying to think of good examples of this, and like my mind turned to some actors who certainly, you know, have kind of like a smoldering stare, or have, you know, good at the stoic type characters, or especially mm-hmm. the sort of Joe Cool characters, you know, as I think of them, where, you know, it's like it's playing some cool dude who's like a detective or something, and he's, you know, he's acting pretty much unfazed by everything around him. But I think the better example I ended up turning to is Harry Dean Stanton, who often played very sort of emotionally muted characters, I would say, though not Joe Cool characters, you know, not a right. character that's so far above it all that he feels completely at ease.
Oh, I think Harry Dean's potentially another great example. Yeah.
Yeah. And another, like, actually kind of like a suite of answers that came to mind were from the Alien film franchise, the various actors that you had playing androids. Specifically, thinking of Ian Holm, Lance Hendrickson, and Michael Fassbender, all three very talented actors, but in all cases, they're supposed to be playing this artificial human type of being that has no emotions, but has an intent. And depending on which film you're landing on and which particular incarnation of the android, that intent may be benevolent or might lean more neutral or might be malicious.
That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know if I'd go there with Ian Holm, actually, because Ian Holm seems unusually capable of projecting absolute blank neutrality, where you don't get that ambiguity that spins off in all the directions. Like, I think he would be great to have people like absolutely fail to reproduce the Kuleshov results if you have him doing blank face. But other ones you're saying, I agree.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, I was just thinking back on those films, and even though these are the characters that are not supposed to have emotional states, in some cases, I feel like I have a better handle on their emotional states versus other human characters in those pictures.
Hmm, yeah.
But I have to admit, I did not paste all of their photos into our document and put them opposite Soup, so I haven't tested it myself.
Oh, you did put Fassbender next to Soup, though, and I got to say, he looks hungry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He does look like he is about to dine on some soup.
Can't you just imagine a scene of him sensually teaching his twin how to peel a butternut squash?
Yeah, that would be good. Feeding each other soup with wooden spoons.
Yeah. Well, anyway, all this is just to say, and to be fair, maybe some studies have done this and I didn't realize it, but it seems like maybe one good move to try to avoid the inter-actor effects of the stimulus you use in Kuleshov type experiments is to just like get a whole lot of pictures of neutral faces and then serve them up at random. And so you can get kind of the neutral face photo averaged out over a big population instead of having it fluctuate based on like how truly neutral your supposedly neutral face looks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd be delighted to hear from listeners out there what their thoughts are. And there are specific examples from cinema and from the faces of various actors.
You know, I wanted to come back to something, though, which I thought is kind of interesting about this. Even if you only accept that the Kuleshov effect is rather modest or only applies sometimes, it is still pretty interesting that it indicates how flexible the human brain is at constructing artificial scenarios and still applying human logic to them. That, like, you know, you're not observing a real scenario in life where you're trying to guess if somebody is hungry. You're looking at a photo or you're looking at an image on a screen, and then it's being intercut with a coffin that they might be sad at, or just a picture of soup or something. And we start applying the same logic we apply to real life to these obviously artificial stimuli.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a great reminder of just how film works and other mediums of art, but especially film, they still require a viewer. And if there's not a viewer, if there's not a moviegoer, there's no film experience, and therefore there's no film. And so there's, no matter how polished the thing on the screen is, there's something that takes place not only between the film and the viewer, but inside the viewer's mind that's critical.
And that a lot of times we don't notice how many gaps we're filling in as film viewers. Like, you don't realize how much work you're doing. And it's work that is apparently pretty easy to do. It's just something we tend to do pretty much automatically while we're watching movies, is fill in those gaps of logic, make connections between one image and another, make assumptions about what's going on in an actor's head when they're portrayed on screen based on the context or the music or, you know, what was shown just before or after. But it's one of those things where it gets pretty weird when you start to notice all of those like assumptions you're having to make and mental work you're having to do for a movie to make sense, which in reality is a flickering succession of moving images, which, sometimes if you were to be very literal about them are totally unconnected. Like you see like a staircase that's from one state and then a house that's from another, and then somebody's coming in through a front door and you just connect it all. This is all in the same place. Person's just moving through their daily routine.
Yeah. I mean, we often think of viewing films and watching TV programs as being kind of a shut your brain off kind of a situation, at least with certain types of film and TV. And, we think that, okay, if it's a highly crafted product, we're not going to have to in mainstream product, we're not going to have to do much thinking. It's going to hold our hand the whole way. But even in the case of your sort of, by the numbers summer blockbuster, very much repeating a plot you've seen before with the sort of characters you've seen before, yeah, your brain is still filling in these little gaps, like you say. But on the same hand, I think one thing we can drive home based on what we've been discussing here is that the opposite, in a way, is true. Is that if you're dealing with a film that, say, is of a genre you're not that familiar with, or a time period of filmmaking you're not that familiar with, perhaps it's more of an art film, or it's foreign language, etc. A lot of it is still going to come down to human or humanoid entities interacting with things in each other, and then our brain is going to make presumptions about their mental state and their emotional state.
Oh, yeah. You infer drama even when the thing you're looking at is almost actively resisting it. And that goes beyond movies, in fact. I mean, what is drama? Drama is somebody wanting something or trying to get something and then coming up against resistance in some way.
Yeah.
People infer those kinds of dramas on like balls rolling around on a table. There are literally studies of that. You know, people will say like the ball wanted to go down in this hole, but it couldn't get there because something was preventing it.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close it out there, but we would love to hear from everybody. If you have particular thoughts on the Kuleshov effect, various examples and studies we've discussed in these episodes, some of the various examples from film and acting that we have alluded to. Perhaps you have some better examples that you would like to bring to our attention. Just write in and let us know. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, check it out in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. You'll find that wherever you get your podcasts. We have core episodes on Tuesday and Thursday. We have listener mail on Monday, short form artifact episode on Wednesday, and on Friday we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious matters and just discuss a weird film. If you want a quick way to get to our podcast, you can just go to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That should still redirect you over to the iHeart listing for our page.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nichols. Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.